And welcome back to Fully Equipped, Golf.com's gear-focused podcast, where we take weekly PGA Tour news related to golfers of all skill levels. I'm Tim Briand, Senior Vice President of True Spec Golf, joined by the Managing Editor for Golf.com, Jonathan Wall. Jonathan, what's happening, man?
Professor, you sound rough.
Yeah, it's really rough. PGA show followed by the Waste Management Phoenix Open.
I was about to say, what was last week? That was the Waste Management Phoenix Open. I'm guessing you probably spent a couple of days hanging out at around 16.
Yeah, the company had a box on the 16th tee box, and I had
must
the pleasure.
Be nice.
Had the pleasure of spending most of the weekend out there.
Nice, that's good.
Honestly, I didn't watch a shot, so shame on me. So. But it was a great week. The event is, I'm surprised that other events haven't tried to copy paste what they do there.
I think the Byron Nelson used to, before they moved it to Trinity Force. And I know this will be the last year at Trinity Force. And I'm assuming they're probably going to go back to Four Seasons in the interim, but being a Texas guy, I've been to that event. I mean, more years than I can count. And that, I would say that was the closest thing. It had a pretty rowdy atmosphere, but yeah, nothing's like Waste Management. But I agree. I think that at the end of the day, you're trying to get more fans to show up, even if they're not golf fans, just sports fans in general. And one way to do that is to kind of give it a rowdy atmosphere. But you know, Phoenix and that whole area as a whole, I mean, it's perfect for what they're trying to do year in, year out. So
I grew up in the Miami area, and that for a while was the longest running event at the same facility at Doral. You know, I kind of grew up over at Doral. They lost their event a few years back, and I couldn't understand why they didn't try to copy the Waste Management Phoenix Open model in Miami.
What was the atmosphere like there? I mean, since you're a Miami
dead.
Guy, what was
it's the it whole was. Reason that's they pulled the thought. Event? There was nobody went to the event, so.
Yeah, you know. I mean, it was just every time that I went there, and again, it was early in the week when, you know, rarely the fans are showing up except for the ones that are trying to get autographs. But yeah, it always just felt like it was just absolutely dead out there. And I couldn't understand that. Miami just seems like a sports crazy town. You'd think people would want to come out and hang and see the big names. But yeah, they never really did, it feels like.
More than anything, it's an entertainment driven town, so. The nightlife out on South Beach and everything else. I can't believe they didn't bring that flavor out on the golf course. But in any event, there was a lot of great stuff that came out of last week, not just at Phoenix, at the Phoenix Open, but also from Saudi Arabia as well.
Yeah.
We've got some great topics to get into. Got Brooks Koepka switching drivers. Titleist had a heck of a week out here in the desert. Chris Kirk switched all through the bag, actually. Changed quite a few pieces of equipment in there. We've got an introduction of a really interesting new product from TaylorMade, a putter product. And then we'll do some mailbag question. And got an interview this week with Aaron Dill from Titleist. You'll make the introduction to Aaron, but he's kind of the wedge guru out on tour. So should be a great episode.
He's the wedge goat. The wedge goat.
That's right. Coming out of Saudi Arabia this week, we had Brooks switching drivers. Sounds like he went from a TaylorMade product to a Callaway product. That's pretty big news, huh?
Yeah, it is big news, Tim, and here's why. You know, Brooks is a free agent, so he can play what he wants. But since his deal with Nike on the gear side evaporated when Nike exited the hard goods industry at the end of 2016, he's played TaylorMade woods. I mean, that's been his product of choice in the driver and in the three wood. And you know, it's worked out well for him. He's won four majors with it. So why change? And you know, he decides to switch it up this weekend. And it was, I would say, it was by far the most interesting change. And the reason why is because of how it kind of transpired. He started the year off with TaylorMade Sim Driver. That's their new 2020 product. Didn't really, you know, at least based on what he was using after that week, didn't seem like he was all that comfortable with it. Went back to M5 at the start of the week in Saudi Arabia, and then midway through the tournament decides to throw Callaway's Maverick Sub-Zero. That's the low spin version in the bag. And I think it just kind of threw some people for a loop because, again, he's been a TaylorMade guy since he became a free agent, and now he's switching products. And I think this is, you know, for me, this is by far one of the more intriguing moves because, you and I have talked about this before, but when big names switch and have success, you know, Brooks shot 65 with Maverick Sub-Zero in the bag during the third round and didn't play all that well on Sunday. But, you know, sometimes those changes out on tour can have a little bit of a domino effect. Maybe we see some other free agents give Callaway's driver a try. You know, and I also, just from social media, I posted some photos of Brooks with a driver, and the tweet I sent out exploded, and a couple of people said, you know, well, I guess I'm going to get a Callaway driver. And it always makes me wonder, you know, when a guy like Brooks or, you know, Tiger, whoever, switches product, and how many regular golfers does that affect? You know, and I don't know if you can really capture an accurate number, but it does make you think about, you know, who out there went out and bought a Callaway Maverick Sub-Zero driver just because Brooks had it in the bag.
So with the M5 product that he came from, do you know if that was the M5 Tour or the regular M5?
Yeah, I mean, it's the tour head. It's, I mean, I don't really know very many guys out on tour that are playing. You know, we talked about this, like standard products. Those the tour heads have little, you know, tweaks here and there. But yeah, the Brooks was playing the tour head in the M5. And
so the first place I go to with this, Jonathan, is the head volume. So when you look at Sim right. is a 460cc product. Sim Max is 460cc. Sim Max D is 460cc. So this is the
Maverick
first time.
Smaller.
So this is the first time that TaylorMade doesn't have a smaller volume head out at the marketplace. Now, something tells me that they may have another head that the tour players have access to that could be smaller volume. You know, when we're talking Tiger, I know that he prefers smaller volume heads as well. So something tells me that maybe there may be a version of the Sim or Sim Max that
yeah,
may be
you
a
know,
little
and
smaller
and
volume.
Maverick Sub-Zero is 450, so you're right. I mean, that is kind of an interesting change that maybe a lot of people weren't looking at. You know, with in terms of spin, I mean, yeah, I mentioned that Maverick Sub-Zero is the lower spinning product, but you know, with M5, it had that T-track. I mean, you can jack the weights right up against the face and get low spin property. So that's, you know, it's not like he's really looking for lower spin. One of the things that you and I both saw, I remember during robot testing, was just how fast, from a ball speed perspective, the Maverick products were. Maverick Sub-Zero, Maverick Max, the standard Mav. They were just really fast, and yep. And you know, maybe he just saw some more speed with this product.
That's right, and we also saw at a Sub-Zero in particular, for a tour caliber lower spin product, we saw more stability than we've seen at a previous iteration. So if you looked at Epic Flash Sub-Zero, and then before that, you know, the tour product that was with the Rogue line, and then the original Epic. I can definitely say that the Maverick Sub-Zero model is a little more stable than those other Sub-Zero models that have been out in the recent 3, 4, 5 years from Callaway.
That's sort of been the knock on Sub-Zero low spin products as a whole. I mean, you and I were kind of looking at this during robot testing. It's so difficult when you're really moving the CG around. And yep. and you know, placing it so far forward, one of the things that you typically sacrifice is forgiveness. And that's why if you're not a better player, it's always been kind of told, look, you know, yeah, you're gonna get low spin, but if you don't hit it pretty much dead center on a consistent basis, you're gonna really suffer on those heel and toe mishits. And you're right, that Sub-Zero product, the Maverick, was really stable. And that's one of the things that Callaway mentioned when I talked to them, kind of getting the rundown on the new Maverick product, was that this, yes, it's low spin, but they really worked on trying to manage the overall forgiveness so that if you don't hit it consistently out of the center, you're still gonna get that mishit protection.
Yep. My biggest takeaway here, though, has to be brand agnostic. Obviously, this is a cornerstone of what we do at TrueSpec. We don't play any preference towards brands, products, price points, any of that sort of stuff. It's all performance driven. And obviously, at the tour level, you know, performance is the name of the game. So, you know, we've seen this movement in the equipment industry for players that have had a lot of success without contracts. Brooks is obviously the poster child for this. You know, he's had tens of millions of dollars thrown his way and has preferred to stay with the option of being flexible throughout his bag. And here we see a couple of events into, you know, the new calendar year and the product that he had been testing, he decided to switch back to his old driver, which, by the way, you know, if he was under contract, a lot of these contracts state that they have to play the newest iteration of the brand's products.
Yeah, so, but I think early in the year, you know, manufacturers are a little bit more, you know, they'll give guys a longer leash. But you're right, you know, they typically, if you're under contract for 14, they're going to tell you, look, you got to play the new driver at some point.
And then made a decision. You know what? Let's go outside of the TaylorMade family and try some other options. Found something that he liked and went with it. Obviously, had some success in the event. You know, so. I really do think that you're going to see more and more players go to brand agnostic setups where they're not dedicated towards one brand.
Oh,
most players 100%. Understand. Yeah. That most players 100%. Understand that there's so much more money on the table when you're talking about, you know, the purses. And now that you have FedEx Cup and things like this, where they have, you know, amazing earning opportunities on the golf course, not to mention the fact that if you're playing gear that is compromising your scores, because maybe there are a couple pieces in the bag that, you know, could be optimized with a different brand a little bit more than what you have in there. You're passing up the opportunity for future money because of, you know, the difference between first and 30th out on tour, it's razor thin. So
no, you're right. And look, at the end of the day, we've discussed this in the past, is the money, the endorsement money for club deals, it's just not there anymore. Unless you are a top 10 player in the world.
It is there for Brooks, and he still doesn't want it.
Well, you're exactly right. But you know, I think players are starting to recognize that unless they're a marketable marquee name, you know, there are guys in the top 10 that I would say, sure, you know, maybe they get big money, but you know, manufacturers, I think more than ever are looking at what's the ROI that I'm getting here if I'm going to be paying a guy a couple, you know, $2-3 million a year to play our stuff. Like what are we getting it for it in return? And look, Tiger Woods couldn't keep Nike afloat in the hard goods industry. So I don't think there's anybody out there that's going to sell more golf clubs. But if you're going to have a visible guy out on the PGA Tour, you need to be able to get something back. I mean, it needs to kind of be like what people were telling me on social media when they saw Brooks playing a Callaway Maverick is, oh, wow, Brooks is playing a Callaway Maverick. I guess that's what I'm going to be playing. I mean, that's what you want. You want somebody who at the end of the day is going to maybe sell a couple more drivers or at least get your product some more, some additional visibility. So yeah, I think brand agnostic is something that we're going to continue to keep seeing as manufacturers continue to tighten the purse strings when it comes to those endorsement deals.
And with that, Jonathan, let's get into our second tour topic of the week, which is Titleist at the Waste Management Phoenix Open. Wow. What a week.
Yeah, no kidding. And I think this kind of goes back to something we really saw from them last year, which is they continue to keep sweeping the equipment counts almost across the board. And that's what we saw in Phoenix. They swept every equipment count category from drivers, hybrids, utilities, irons. I mean, they swept it all. And they actually almost did the exact same thing on the Korn Ferry. They only missed out on one of the counts.
And they produced the winner.
Exactly. They did, you know, and we continue to keep seeing it. I mean, Webb Simpson, man, that I think Kyle Porter from CBS Sports mentioned that Webb could be the hottest American out on tour right now. And I didn't realize that he hadn't posted a finish worse than 30th going back to like the middle of 2019, which is insane.
Hasn't missed a cut in how long?
Listen, I don't even know. He's so consistent. He's one guy that we just rarely talk about. But you know, you're right. He won. He's a Titleist staffer through the bag, with the exception of that Odyssey putter that he uses, the arm lock method. And you know, Finau even is a Pro V1 guy with the golf ball. But yeah, you know, this is something that we really started to see last year, Tim. And I wrote a story about this. Just the shift in the perception with one club in particular. With Titleist, and that would be the driver. You know, I think even Titleist had admitted to me last year that look, you know, the driver for us has typically not been something that we've you know, really tried to go after speed, and that was the main thing, the Titleist speed project with their new TS drivers that they really wanted to do, and we've seen it. You know, there's been a huge push from them. And now we're starting to see it. And it seems, I mean, really, I honestly think the driver was kind of the opening of the floodgates for them, because as soon as they started to get more drivers out on tour, it was like every other count kind of followed suit. And they had success in wedges and ball and putter, but to get fairways and hybrids and utilities and really just across the board, they were clean sweeping it a bunch of times last year.
Yeah, we spoke with Stephanie Luttrell, you know, a few months back. Stephanie heads up the Metalwoods. Yeah, she heads up the Metalwoods design team over at Titleist. And this has been a design, you know, a major point of design emphasis is to increase speed off the face. How'd they do it? They're using discretionary weight by, you know, thinning out other parts of the club to save weight and then be able to use that weight in usually it's moving the weight more forward. If you look at TS4, you'll see a weight port that's closer to the face. You know, we saw this out of the ball speeds throughout club test, out of TS3 and TS4, where they were just jumping off the face, and it was very surprising. I mean, I know how surprised you were to see some of this.
I almost ate my hat.
That's right. So if I said to you 4 or 5 years ago that Titleist would clean sweep an event all the way ball through driver and win the event, you'd probably thought I was crazy. They've always made great irons. They've always made great wedges. Obviously their ball, is amazing. I've always liked their hybrids and fairway woods, but remember, those are not products where you're looking at, you know, just pure speed off the face. When it came to
have you played their fairway woods and hybrids, Tim, in your bag? Have you played?
I have actually played their fairways. See, I have. Really I don't have. Play a hybrid, so yeah. Their fairways are outstanding. Their fairways are outstanding. So anybody that hasn't tried a Titleist, especially these TS products from Taylor. Clean that up, Mark. Anybody that hasn't tried a TS product from Titleist, especially in the fairway wood, I would encourage you to do so. They have a great shape to them. They're not overly difficult to hit. You know, Titleist had a perception for so many years as being a brand that was really designed for better players, more skilled players. You know, they've done an amazing job at broadening out their product lines to include stuff that's available for the everyday player that enhances performance. You know, the fairway woods are easy to hit. The hybrids, I don't use hybrids, but I see it every day in fittings with clients. We do very, very well with the Titleist hybrids over at TruSpec. But the driver was the one thing that, you know, when we would work with some of the players that had contracts, you know, they would see peers driving it past them. They're hitting it past them with only the driver. So Eric Compton comes to mind. Eric is a good friend of mine that we grew up together down in Miami. And, you know, he was on Titleist deal for many years. He's hitting it longer than guys with the irons, longer than a lot of guys on the fairway woods, even though he's not a big, you know, even though he's not big in stature, does generate a decent amount of speed. But then on the driver, he would 15, 20 behind them. And that was going back, you know, many years at this point. Well, that's not happening anymore. The TS series drivers have really, really enhanced ball speed. We do very well with them at TruSpec. So it's not surprising to see so many adopt them out on tour. And so, you know, when you look at Webb, yeah, one of the most consistent players out on the tour the last couple of years, kind of flies under the radar a little bit. So it was just an amazing week for Team Titleist out at the Waste Management Phoenix Open. And be curious to see how they continue that success going forward into the year.
Tim, what have you seen from, you know, we always are kind of coming at this from a tour angle initially when we're talking about products, but what have you seen at TruSpec when it comes to the Titleist product? You know, I know that you've worked with tour players on it, but what's kind of been that
so general consensus? The TS1 product is really kind of designed for that player that, you know, doesn't create as much speed. I mean, let's consider this. Right now, there are 4 really good driver designs out of Titleist.
Yeah,
there aren't many brands that have 4 of them. So, the TS1 is designed for folks that maybe don't have the speed that tour players have, that struggle to generate the launch and spin needed to keep the ball airborne. Folks that don't have a lot of carry on their driver, and this is what we see, you know, with ladies, with seniors. You know, juniors that aren't quite, you know, 14, 15 years old, you know, younger junior players, anybody that doesn't have 110, 105 plus mile an hour club head speed, the TS1 product is great at generating a bit of launch, and also helping maintain spin to keep the ball airborne. And then when you look at the TS4 product, you know, it's a smaller shaped package as far as the overall volume in the club head. The weight is pushed forward, the face is thinned. This is a product that's designed for a better player, and it's fast. It's really, really fast. It was one of the, I think it was one of the top three fastest clubs that we tested in the robot room. And I shared that feedback with the Titleist team, and they were elated that, you know, other people are seeing some of the results that they've seen through their own research and testing. So we do very well with the Titleist products. You know, unfortunately, they kind of suffered from a hit to the reputation for a couple years. And so
it's tough to change people's perception, you know, when especially when consumers perceive a product to be, you know, really stable and consistent, which is what we'd always seen from Titleist products, but not necessarily fast. You're right. It is tough to change that perception.
So, you know, like I said, I'll be very interested to see what happens throughout the rest of this year with the Titleist product line out on tour. I think it's going to be a great year for them. You know, they introduced their new iron series, the T-Series irons, back in the fall. They're outstanding. They now just added two new models to that iron lineup with the T100S and the T400. So, yeah, it's looking like it's going to be a strong year for Titleist. Sure. And so last tour topic of the week, Chris Kirk. I understand that he's made some wholesale changes to the bag.
My favorite tour topic of the week.
And,
I mean, this has been crazy, Tim. Yeah. I mean, look, I can't believe this. We are for back-to-back weeks talking about a tour player using a draw bias product. I mean, I in all the years that I've been covering gear, I cannot ever tell you a time where I remember hearing about two, not just like two tour players, but a guy that won a major, Keegan Bradley, switching to TaylorMade's SimMax D, their draw bias product. Then the following week, you get a PGA Tour winner in Chris Kirk, a multi PGA Tour winner, I should mention, switching to a draw bias product, also lighter, which I think is probably something we need to get into as well. But yeah, this is an interesting one. So Chris decided to make some, I would consider it to be wholesale changes. He changed out his driver head and then also went to, as we'll get to in a little bit, went to lighter iron shafts. But the change with the driver, he went from Mizuno's ST200, it's their you know, new product for 2020, into the ST200X. And Tim, do you know much about the 200X?
Well, it's a lot lighter, number one. And
it was developed with their Japanese team, you know, and I know you spent a lot more time over in Asia than I have, but what I've learned is that over in Asia, they really like the lighter products, you know, anything in that, you know, sub 40 gram range for a shaft, and, you know, something in the, I mean, this is the 200X is a D2 product. It's also going to be longer, and I can get into the technical specs here in a minute for people that are curious. But yes, Chris so went to a 10 Japanese, and a half degree.
Japanese spec usually is a little bit flatter. It's a lot longer, lighter. Right. Usually the shafts are more flexible. They're not as scared of a draw biased product over there. So it's, you know, when you flatten a club, usually that'll make it more fade biased. But then, you know, the flatter products, you know, typically fit the folks over there a little bit better. But so, you know, it is a very different product than what you get here in the United States. And so the really, really interesting thing about this is how many times have you heard a tour player want to take the right side of the golf course out of play?
Yeah. It's kind of interesting.
I mean, I don't think I've ever heard of a tour player that's scared of right. Almost everybody lives in terror of the left side of the golf course, whether it be poles, hooks, etc. And here Chris is trying to take right out of play. You know, bottom line is, when you're talking about golf course management, you have to have the ball working in one direction, meaning it's either got to be working to the right almost all the time or working to the left. You know, you talk about a 40-yard wide fairway. If you have to aim it down the center of the fairway and allow for 20 yards left or right, that's a lot harder to play than if you can aim it down one side of the fairway and use the entire width of the fairway. Right. So, you know, from a course management perspective, I just don't know of very many tour players that I've ever heard of that are actually wanting to make the ball curve left.
And he's going to the lower lofted setting, so it's a 10.5 degree head,
but it's upright.
but you're right, it's upright, and he's going down in loft 1 degree. I went and just kind of checked the specs on these, Tim. So the 200 compared to the 200X, the 200 is at 9.5 is D3, 10.5 is D4 at 45 inches. The 200X, if you were going to, and I'm talking retail specs here, not what Chris is playing, but it's D2 at 10.5 degrees, and it's played at 45.75. So it's 3/4 of an inch longer with the 200X, kind of as you mentioned, longer product, especially when you're talking about something like this that was kind of a collaboration between Mizuno North America and in Japan. You're, you know, lighter, longer. And the standard lie angle on these was also kind of interesting. It's between, you know, again, with this being a adjustable loft sleeve, it's 56.5 to 59.5 on the 200, but the 200X is 59 to 62. So it's significantly more upright.
Yep. So, you know, the other part of this story is the changes to the irons, which I believe he's gone to a significantly lighter setup from Project X LZ shafts, which are in that 120 gram up to 130 gram weight. Into Dynamic Gold S200s, which are a good bit lighter. And I think the idea here was to generate a little bit more spin. But when you start to look at it, it seems like through the entire bag that he's gone to a lighter setup. So this is very different than a lot of the setups we see out on the PGA Tour. It's actually more similar to setups that we start to see for amateur players. So, you know, very curious as to the S200 shaft change. Most players these days are going to heavier and stiffer, and now we're seeing somebody go into something that's lighter with a little more active tip.
But I don't think ST200's that much. I mean, the 200s, I think, are 127, I think, is to be a real gear nerd here, actually, because I played Dynamic Gold for so long. I think they're like 126, 127 in the ST200s. And I think LZ's probably somewhere around there because it's, you know, it's that LZ product is trying to launch the ball high. ST200's not something that you almost ever really see. Yeah, I mean, it's to me, it's almost really been more of a retail product because you're so used to seeing tour players living in that S3, S400 range. You know, we see so many tour players using the S400 in their wedges. And you know, again, another topic we've discussed on previous Fully Equipped podcasts is the number of tour players that use X100 in their irons and then use S400 in their, and, you know, that was something that Tiger Woods kind of made popular just because he was looking for a little bit more give, but still wanted a, you know, a fairly heavy shaft. But yeah, S200, that's not something that you typically ever see a tour player use. And here he is using it as iron and wedges as well.
Yep, that's exactly right. So with that, let's get into our gear spotlight for the week. And TaylorMade introduced a new line of putters. We mentioned this actually when we were over in Korea because there was a photo that leaked from the Zozo of Tiger Woods using a very interesting putter. You know, due to embargoes, had to play that one close to the vest. But
always,
you know,
do.
This was a product that I got my eyes on back in September last year. It's called TaylorMade Truss, and Truss is referring to an engineering feature. You know, truss obviously is something in the engineering world that adds stability and structure and support. And so Billy Price, who heads up putter design over at TaylorMade, was trying to solve for an issue, which is, you know, we've seen MOI become a very popular thing in putter design. The idea behind MOI is that if you hit the ball off the center of the face isn't going to twist as much, the ball's not going to lose as much energy coming off the face, and you don't have as much face angle change. So the thing is how do you arrive at a higher MOI putter? In most cases, it has to do with mass. You increase mass, you move the mass to the exterior of the design. So you start looking at mallets, and you start looking at some of these fang mallets and high MOI designs like that. But how do you enhance MOI in a traditional blade? And this was the thing that he was trying to solve for. So their solution was this new hosel design. It's not really all that new. Those of us that have been in the gear industry for a while know that there are some precursors to this design, which are somewhat similar. Most common being the Titleist dead center putter. That was, a couple decades old at this point, I think. But the idea is that by adding two different contact points between the shaft and the club head, through that truss design, that's going to help enhance stability.
They did a lot of data gathering on this, Tim. They analyzed 40,000 putts from golfers of varying handicaps and found that, the most inconsistent location, for a lot of those putts was towards the toe, which kind of facilitated this design. But anyway, sorry, I just wanted to bring that up.
Yeah. And so this is stuff that the data that they use is all derived from, the precursor to the system they're using nowadays was the mat system. The mat system is actually what I worked on as a club fitter when I worked on the TaylorMade team. And that has now become the Gears sports system. And these are motion capture systems that really look at what's happening at a very, very detailed level. When you're talking about, motion, both athletic motion of the player and movement patterns, as well as what's happening with the club. And so, Dwayne Anderson, who heads up the putter team as far as the research and the fitting side of things for TaylorMade, who, by the way, is where I've learned so much from, and I have to give him some credit for everything I learned when I worked for that team. And, it's been fantastic to put all that knowledge to use now that I've moved on. And I don't understand why Dwayne isn't more well-known than he is. He should be considered at the upper echelon of all the folks in this industry as far as his knowledge and what he's seen and researched. But they used all this data from thousands of players on the gear system to help them try to figure out a better design. So the solution is to put this truss pattern up, into the hosel section. Now, from the top, the first thing you that comes to mind when you look at this is that, man, how do you look down at that? Well, they've done an amazing job at fooling the eye. When you look down at it from the playing position, you don't see that really large that neck shape. It hides very well. Obviously, it's very prominent when you're looking down the line. But there are a couple of issues that I think are worth considering with the design. Number one is you are definitely moving mass. And in putter design, typically, when you move mass towards the face, that's going to make the face close more through the impact zone. So for somebody that's missing a lot of putts left, this may be a design that could be a little more challenging for you because, once again, moving that much mass forward in the face and pulling the mass towards the face could end up with, some face closure issues. The next big concern that I would have is in a custom fitting world, how do you bend that truss design when you're talking about loft and lie? Now, I spoke with Trotty, who's over on the TaylorMade team, very popular and knows his stuff. And the lie angle isn't as big as the issue as the loft. If the way that they've designed that neck style is predicated upon a certain loft package and then you bend that neck, does that mean that truss feature all of a sudden becomes visible to the eye? So this will be something interesting that I want to keep track of. This last weekend I had breakfast with George Gankus with the tournament in town. It's always great to spend time with George. And well, the reason being that he was asking me for some advice and showed me some video of Matt Wolf throughout this last week with his putting. And lo and behold, Matt had truss in the bag. So I think Ben On also had truss in the bag this week. So
yeah, there were and Luke List played putted really well with truss. I think it was the week prior. So
yep.
It's starting to gain a little bit of traction.
Yeah, and when you're talking about these kinds of radical putter designs, would Spider have ever been a thing? I mean, Spider has become one of the best selling putters in the marketplace. Before Spider was introduced, TaylorMade was, I think, number four in market share when it came to putters. And now they're, you know, number one, number two. And they've really grabbed a ton of market share with Spyder. If the tour players hadn't used Spyder and hadn't adopted and hadn't had the success they did out on tour, would Spyder have become a thing? Probably not. I think that pyramid of influence influences putter sales more than any other category. You look at, you know, all these different players that have used specific putter brands and styles, and it's no secret that, you know, Scotty Cameron, Newport 2 style, I think a lot of sales get attributed to Tiger in that product. So pyramid of influence is very important. So this is going to be a product that TaylorMade. Yeah, TaylorMade is going to have to get their tour staff behind this idea in order to see it start to become popular at the point of sale with consumers. So, you know, interesting idea. I always love products that are thinking outside the box, trying to solve problems. And I'll be, you know, I'll be curious to see how it works with a lot of players as we start to test it, you know, with true specs. So with that, let's get into our mailbag for the week, Jonathan.
Yeah, let's do it. This week's question comes from Jorge Hernandez. He asks, he wants to know about shaft weight, Tim. He says, when we say that a shaft weighs 120 grams, is that the weight of the shaft for all of the irons or for an established shaft length?
All right. So the short answer is it depends. Like with most things when you're talking about golf equipment. Like with most things when you're talking about golf equipment, there are some products which are labeled constant weight products. And for a constant weight product, if it says it's 95 grams, it'll be 95 grams for all of the clubs in the bag. So 7-iron, 8-iron, 9-iron, et cetera. When we're talking about the total gram weight of the shaft, is that raw or is that cut? Most typically, that's going to be raw. After you cut, you know, whether you're cutting from the tip section, if it's a parallel tip shaft for frequency matching purposes, or if you're cutting just from the butt section, you are going to be removing some mass out of the raw shaft weight. So now when you're talking about through the bag, 9-iron, 8-iron, 7-iron, 6-iron, constant weight products will be the same gram weight, you know, wedged through whatever iron you're building to. Most products have an incremental weight variation. And obviously when you're talking about a 3-iron shaft, it's much longer than a pitching wedge shaft. Wall thicknesses could be slightly different when you're going up through that set of shafts. So you may have some variations in weight, you know, through the bag, and usually it's minimal. Now you do have some other products which have been introduced, which are ascending weight products. And the idea there is to make the weight of the wedge product shaft significantly heavier than what you get in the long iron shaft.
The reason for that is to get
higher launch. We saw this with AMT from Dynamic Gold. I've got a set of ascending weight Nippons in my office. And in that case, the weight from a pitching wedge to a 3-iron would be radically different, you know, in the order of, you know, 10, 15, 20 grams of magnitude. So like everything in the golf industry, when you're talking about comparing, you know, products, the answer here is it depends on what type of product you're talking about. So this is one thing that I would advise any consumer, be a little more educated. If you don't have access to information, then make sure that you trust a fitter that has a great reputation, that really knows what they're doing. Because obviously when you go to build with these different products, whether it be a constant weight product or a traditional incremental weight change product or an ascending weight product, if you're trying to build to certain swing weights, this is going to be a radically different build from one product to the next. So if you aren't using somebody that is very experienced and knowledgeable, you could end up with a set that is really all over the place as far as the build spec. And then obviously that would impact the performance, and you may see a lot of change throughout the bag as far as performance too.
You hit the nail on the head. You need to know what you're trying to accomplish before you go in there, or at least have somebody, as Tim mentioned, a certified club fitter is the guy that you need to go see. And have them, you know, bounce some ideas off of them, and they can kind of let you know what's out there. there are a ton of options in the shaft category, and I don't think a lot of people really ever consider some of them, just because, kind of like with the products in their bag, they get so set on, well, these are my specs, these are the clubs that I play, so when the new version comes out, I'm just going to switch to that, which is all well and good if you're a good player and that's what you know, but there's nothing wrong with kind of sniffing around and seeing if there are other options out there, especially when it comes to shafts, as you mentioned.
Well, perfect time to get into our interview for the week. This one's a great one. We've got the wedge guru out on the tour that works with the Titleist team, Aaron Dill. Aaron Dill has really come to a level of prominence in the equipment world. A lot of folks may know who Aaron is. He's the stamp master for sure. Nobody else is doing what he does when it comes to stamping and customizing wedges for the different tour folks that he works with. But can't wait for this interview. And with that, let's get to it.
All right, with Vokey's SM8 wedge out in the wild on tour and retail now, I figured it made sense to get someone on here who knows a thing or two about the wedge, not to mention wedge stamping. I'm excited to have Vokey Tour up Aaron Dill joining me today. Aaron, Happy New Year, and thanks again for hopping on the Fully Equipped Podcast.
Hey, Happy New Year to you. Thanks for having me.
All right. Everyone knows you as Vokey's tour rep, but I know you worked extremely hard to get out on tour. How did you get started in the industry, and what was the road like that led you to working with guys like JT, Brooks, Adam Scott on a regular basis?
Yeah, I think my path's a lot like most people's paths who get out here and do this kind of job. Is, you know, we all fall in love with the game of golf. And I was raised playing golf with my dad and played it through school and knew I was never going to be good enough to compete on tour. That was never my goal, but definitely loved golf enough to make it a career and a passion. And just was very fortunate through those years to run into some great people who were already in the industry and who I could learn from and absorb things from and, you know, right place, right time. And here we are today. 15 years with the Acushnet, and it couldn't be happier.
Do you still kind of have any of those pinch me moments? I know you said 16 years now out there. Are there any moments still when you're out working at tour events where you're like, man, I can't believe that I get to do this for a living?
All the time. You know, I'm so fortunate, seriously. I think you ask anybody who gets to go out every week and work with tour players and go to different cities and do this job, and you realize, like, just how blessed you are to be able to have that position. I think anybody who gets that chance, they hold on to this job for dear life, because it really is a special job, and it's extremely hard work, but very rewarding and something that I think we all really enjoy doing enough to make it a job for life.
All right, Voke is a living legend in the golf space. What's it like working with him on a regular basis, and how has your relationship with him kind of evolved over the years?
Yeah. So in the very beginning, when I first started with Titleist, again, that was coming up on 15 years ago, Bob was very gracious. You know, Bob was like this legend. I didn't know Bob at all. I knew his equipment. I knew just who the guy was based on photographs and everything. And he was like a hero to me. And right. So to be able to work for him today is a super cool thing. But back then, you know, I didn't know him very well, but I was kind of like a gnat in his ear, just like bugging him all the time, you know, trying to pick his brain and learn from the guy. And he was so gracious. He'd let me come in his office and he'd share his time with me and he'd give me advice and, you know, he'd coach me on certain things. And a lot of the really great advice that he shared with me years and years ago, I still carry with me today. So, yeah, he's just this great guy, full of knowledge. And you know, as far as our relationship has evolved over the years, you know, we first started together, it was business. You know, I was learning. I was an apprentice. He was my mentor, and he was teaching me all this stuff. And it was business all the time. But as the years have gone on and we've spent more and more time together and we've kind of taken things to deeper personal levels, we're really more, in my mind, family than we are co-workers. You know, Bob's like he's like a father to me, and I think he might mirror that sentiment in saying that I'm almost like a son, and that's a big reason why we are as close as we are.
I'm curious, how long did it take for Bob to kind of build some trust in you? Because, you know, I look at some of the things that you're doing now, not just on tour, but you have a wedge with your name on it. How long did it take for Bob to kind of get to that point where he trusted you enough with some of the ideas that you were kind of dishing out to him for him to go, yeah, you know what, let's roll with that?
Well, I think I certainly can't speak for Bob. In my mind, you know, it takes years, and it's not just about you know, like, hey, you've been doing this a long time. It's you know, what are your relationships like with your players? Are your counts growing? Is the product you're producing getting people's attention? All these little things, all these little details that I picked up from him when I first started. You know, I think it takes years and years of time out in the field to, you know, to kind of get that trust from your players. And once you have that trust from your players, then I think he started having some of that trust in me. And I think, you know, I remember years and years ago, he would tell me, he's like, hey, I know you're doing a great job, because a lot of the guys that used to call me, they don't call me anymore. Now they just call you. And I think that just goes to show that, you know, all the stuff that I learned over the years from him, and the things that we've done together, and then my experience on tour, you know, I've been able to take some of that stress off of his plate and let him focus on some things. And again, like I said, I think for him, you know, it just takes time and years for him to place that trust in me. And I think today he's, you know, he believes that I can go out there and represent him well.
All right, let's talk Voki SM8, which debuted at Sea Island. How busy was launch week for you? And was there anything in particular that week that went on that sort of surprised you?
Yes. You know, we had to make some scheduling changes. I think anybody who follows our launch schedules, a lot of golf guys do, you know, they know, right, like, okay, driver's coming out here. We've always been known to launch in Las Vegas, and it's a great spot, close to home. We've been doing it for a long time, but with the PGA Tour schedule moving things around a little bit, it made it tricky for us. So we had to make a choice to move our launch date a little bit later in the season. Now, the great thing is that RSM, they have a great golf course there and a great short game area, and arguably one of the most beautiful settings of golf that we see throughout the season. So to go out there and launch there was really, really fun. But it does have its challenges. It's further away. Our band situation was a little further from the range that we had liked. Our field size was larger as well, so we had more guys to seed to. But, you know, the seeding process is complicated. It takes months to do because I go through every single head, every single order as those are being put together. So I've spent a lot of time on the floor making sure that those orders are done properly and that we're paying attention to the little details that all the guys want. So the launch went very, very well. It was very busy. And I think, you know, walking away on Wednesday, we all felt very good about what we accomplished.
Talk a little bit about that seeding process for a second, because I think people, when they, especially those that follow gear closely, I think that when a guy sees a wedge out on tour for the very first week, it's the first time they're seeing it. But that's not really the case. You guys were working for months with tour players after, even longer than that, after SM7 came out, to kind of start getting their you know, feedback on what the new design would look like.
Yeah. You know, building and designing golf clubs is a complicated thing, and it takes us years to do. It's not like we just go out and test for a couple months and, you know, there you go. You know, there is planning involved. There's design elements that we have to think about. And a lot of the stuff that we put into SM8 was thought of years ago. We just wanted to make sure that before we put it into a golf club, that it was exactly what we wanted it to be, and that whatever we put in there does in fact make a difference. And that's really kind of what we stand for, is, you know, that classic Voki shape, but we fill it full of technology and we actually make it do something good. And that takes years of time.
I know the visual CG was a big story with SM6 and SM7. What was the decision behind going back to I guess somewhat concealing some of that CG changes, and how much did tour feedback play a role in the look of the SM8 wedge?
Yeah, so the look of the SM8 wedge, you know, that feedback we get from tour players every day, and that information I share with Bob. And if you look at our general profiles over the years or over the generations, we don't really steer too far away from what we know works. We want to produce a very attractive shape. And so that's kind of always our goal, is in terms of the looks. As far as the technology and the top lines go, that was something that we had talked about around the table. We were like, I wonder if this is going to make people think that we've abandoned our desire to improve CG.
Right.
And the goal of the CG improvements, I mean, that was number one for us. And in order for us to reach the positions that we wanted to get into, we needed to actually set out that top line to do it. There were three things that we were looking at. The first two were X and Y, which is up and down the face and side to side. We knew that we've had a great position there. We didn't really want to change that, but we knew there was a third location, and that's CG forward and back. And the cool thing about CG front and back is that that's what kind of makes the wedge kick open, what creates dynamic locking. And a lot of concerns that tour players have when they're hitting wedge shots is these floaty wedge shots that come up short and don't have the spin that they're used to seeing and kind of give them some inconsistent flights. And that was our goal, was how do we eliminate or minimize those floaty wedge shots that you see with, you know, some of your higher lofted wedges. And that's where our CG study went even deeper. And that's really kind of the goal behind Estimate was, you know, to move that CG further forward to help these guys have these lower flighted, higher spinning wedge shots that carry their numbers better.
Yeah, I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask you about wedge stamping. Can you tell listeners who might not know the story of the Call Me Maybe wedge that you made for Ricky Fowler? Because if I'm not mistaken, that's really kind of where this whole wedge stamping craze began.
When I first started doing wedge stamping, it was on the Fitting Works fan, and it was just initials back then. It was really simple. It was just, you know, A or, you know, whatever, JS. It was real simple stuff. And when I got on tour, we were doing the same things. You know, we were kind of experimenting a little bit with the stamping. But after hanging out with Ricky a little bit, and he was a staffer of ours, we made his wedges. You know, Ricky, he's funny. He's got a great personality. He's full of good ideas. And we would talk about stuff all the time. And you know, the first time we stamped the Call Me Maybe wedge, we were talking about that song by Carly Rae Jepsen. And, you know, we were just goofing off about it. And then we were talking about Justin Bieber. He's got a Justin Bieber fan club VP stamp. We did it on his two wedges, and it was just, we realized in the moment, it was hysterical. It was so funny, you know. And it was that moment where the light kind of came on. You're like, you know, we could really take this to another level. We could have some fun, and we could personalize these things and tell stories, and kind of expose these really good golfers to the world and kind of make them human. You know, when you watch golf, it's like these guys they're the best at what they do, but nobody really knows who they are. And to be able to showcase these little bits and pieces on the back of a golf club and just kind of tell stories about who they are is, I think, a really cool way that our viewers or golf fans can connect.
You know, I know Justin Thomas is, I guess I'd say he's somewhat superstitious when it comes to having the nickname Radar stamped on his Vokey wedges. Do you have any other guys who found a stamp job they really like and had success with it, and they basically told you, hey, look, Aaron, whatever you do, just keep putting this stamp on my wedges?
Yeah, you know, you get a different groups of guys who like different things. You know, Justin is one of those extreme cases where when we first started working together, he had Radar, and then that spun into song lyrics, right? And then after a while, he came back to me and he said, hey, I want to get another set. And I said, what do you want to stamp on this batch? You know, you have any more song lyrics for me? And he'd say, you know what? I haven't been hitting it very well. I'm a little bit concerned about that. So I'm going back to Radar. So I went back to Radar. You know, and he's one of the very few guys that does that. He's not somebody to make big changes. You know, he lets his golf do the talking, and he doesn't change equipment very much unless it's completely necessary. But his stamping Radar is kind of his thing. And we do have other guys like Robert Streb, who every so often when he gets something new, he just kind of lets me do whatever I want. And that's fun, too, because we can be creative and we can expand on ideas and thoughts. And then we have other guys who will have things in their lives that are happening that mean something, you know, that matter, or something funny. And we can take that information and we can be creative and we can tell a story.
You know, you mentioned Robert Streb, and that reminds me of one of my favorite wedges you ever stamped, which was the 17th Island green on the back of a wedge, which I still think is one of your coolest creations, which kind of leads me into my next question, which is, I know this is going to be tough, but give me your three favorite stamp jobs you've done over, let's say, the last like 5 years.
To be completely honest, Jonathan, I mean, I stamp so many things so often in such a hurry that I tend to forget what I'm doing. And I try and take as many pictures as I can. I try to remember as many things as I can. But to be honest, we're going so fast so often. Right. And I think that's something cool to share with like anybody who listens to this podcast is that I don't have a lot of time to stamp. you know, stamping comes second to the quality of the grinding and the wedge work that we do in our fitting processes. That's number one. You know, we try and make sure that whatever we send out of the van is precisely what the guys need based on conditions and swing types and so on. The stamping kind of comes second. You know, those are the fun things that I can do after the hard work is done. But as far as, you know, my stamping favorites goes, man, I can't think of any ones that I truly, truly remember that I love. I did a cool wedge the other day that had a big bacon strip on it. And, you know, I'm doing some stuff with a different color now, and we're doing some sandblast work, and we're doing little things as they come. But again, it's all based on what our players want to, what they want to say, you know, what do we want to do?
Did the younger guys have more fun with the stamping now that it's more of a common thing?
Oh, without a doubt. You know, now, and I think the generation that's coming up to the PGA Tour in the last few years, like they've been exposed to stamping. You know, they see it all the time. They follow, you know, all these different golf outlets, and they see what their tour players, their favorite tour players, what they have in the bag, and they're seeing all this stuff, and they think it's cool. And you see a lot of different brands like our Wedgrix program offering those services, and you know, people want to stamp stuff, and I think our younger groups are definitely embracing that more and more, and that makes my job super fun. Is, you know, us not only like after we do our fitting portion of it, you know, being able to say, okay, now the fun part begins. What are we going to do on the back of this thing? We've got all this open canvas on the back of this Estimate wedge. What do you want to say? You know, and letting them kind of have that freedom as long as it's, you know, PG rated.
All right. Enough of the wedge stamping. I know you get a lot of recognition for that, but you also have to deal with some far more technical wedge situations like grinds. Who has the most technical grind you work on regularly? I'd have to think, you know, from the years that you and I have known each other, I'd have to think Brooks Koepka's M grind has to probably be up there somewhere.
Brooks' grind is a little tricky. And, you know, you look at the history of that grind and where he started, you know, playing on the European Tour. And, you know, he was exposed to firm golf courses in those early years. And he was... sort of in a sense, because of those golf courses, forced into a low bounce 60-degree wedge. But he loved it so much that he's been loyal to it as he's played, you know, basically the majority of his career here on the PGA Tour, and he's just played so well. His grind is complicated. It's built off of a low bounce TVD 60 body. We actually take the forward bounce down about 6 degrees. We flatten that. And, you know, we put a few other little elements in there. But again, it's all about, you know, giving him what he's looking for, which is I want a wedge that sits close to the ground. It makes me have some confidence, like I can get underneath the ball easily. And then just, you know, he likes that speed through the ground. He wants to feel the wedge moving quickly. So, you know, he's one of those guys that has a complicated wedge, not too difficult to make. You know, he certainly wants it done properly. And so that does take some time, but he does have some extensive grinding. We have other guys like Patrick Cantlay, you know, he's got incredible feel. And so we have to be very, very detailed in how we polish his wedges. Same thing goes for, you know, Jordan Spieth. Jordan Spieth is looking for particular shaping elements and offset elements. And Justin Thomas is looking for the same. And so, you know, these guys, they all have these little things that they think about and that they want visually, and they also want in the sound of the acoustics of the wedge that goes through the ground. So, you know, I try and take a lot of mental notes as to what each of these guys are looking for. That way, when we go home and we make them something, or I make something in the trailer, that I'm making it to the standards that they would hope it to be.
You know, I'm not sure how many people realize this, but you're not just working on wedges for Titleist staffers. We mentioned Brooks Koepka there, but also guys who aren't under contract but choose to play Vokey wedges. In my opinion, you are the hardest working rep on tour simply because you have so many guys that you're dealing with on a weekly basis. And that leads me to my question, which is how in the world do you keep it all straight when you're fielding so many wedge requests in a given week?
I don't have a lot of free time.
So, clearly.
You know, I think that's, and I'm sure you've heard this before, and maybe I'm not sure how many rounds of golf you play a year, but one of the misconceptions about being in the golf business is that we all play a lot of golf, and the reality
exactly.
is that
we don't
play a lot of golf, no, and that's, this industry and this job is something that I have a lot of passion for, and I take it very seriously, and I have the privilege of working with Titleist staffers and other players on the PGA Tour And I think that that's super cool. And I don't want to lose that. So I spend a lot of time on the phone, and I spend a lot of time through text and emails, and in person, making sure that all the guys who are playing a wedge or want to play a wedge are getting my attention and my time. And so when I come home, I'm on the grinding wheels. I'm with Bob. You know, we're doing stuff on the floor together. We're designing, we're talking. And I spend a lot of my time here at the office. And when I'm not here at the office, I spend a lot of time at Oceanside fitting and doing some testing work. And when I'm not at home here in San Diego, I'm on the road and I'm doing it there too. So it's a lot of work to do, but I take it seriously. I enjoy it. And I don't want to slow down. I have no desire to slow down anytime. So I keep embracing and bringing in as many guys who want to come in and play our stuff.
You know, you mentioned they're kind of working on the grinding wheel and having Bob around. What's the last thing that you learned from Bob that you've kind of implemented into kind of your daily life and what you do?
Let's see. Well, there's one thing I will say about Bob that I learned in the last few years. And that is, you know, Bob has been really good about taking good care of himself, not only physically, but mentally. You know, he's very good about reading, taking time to rest, which I wasn't always good at. I'm still not great at it yet. And he continues to kind of educate me on how to, you know, take care of yourself, to better live your life. You know, when I first started the job, it was just kind of go, 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 go. There wasn't a lot of, you know, take care, Aaron, you know, get your priorities in check. And that's one thing that I learned a lot from Bob in the last few years is, you know, your priorities they're really important. You know, your family's important. If you're a religious person, that's really important. Your job is important, yes, but, you know, getting your priorities in the right place and making sure that you're using your time wisely is a really important thing. And I'm trying to get better at that. It just takes time. And he's done a great job with that. He keeps sharing that knowledge with me. So I keep trying to improve upon those things.
What is the busiest week of the year for you on tour?
Busiest week of the year on tour? It's probably going to be the next 3 to 4 weeks, you know, basically from now. Sony, you know, the Sony event, you know, you're basically catching up those first few weeks. And once you kind of get into the deep lump of the season right before the Masters, that's when things really start to kick into full speed. You know, we've got to start preparing for things. We've got to start thinking about, you know, going from, you know, different golf course types or grasses, you know, into, you know, some of the more bladey, grainy, sand-based soils. You know, we're having to adjust based on where we are in the country. And then, you know, your guys are just, you know, they're full speed. They're playing golf. They're getting serious. They're doing their best from week to week. And that's where we really start going nuts. And that's the time of year that I really enjoy, because that's when, you know, you're really going full speed and you're learning a lot and you're educating a lot as well. So everybody's kind of benefiting from that time.
You know, I know you do a lot of work with tour players, but for the average golfer out there, you know, one of the questions they ask me, and I think you would be a great resource to answer this, is I have people ask me all the time, man, Vokey has so many wedge grinds out there. And, you know, I know that there's got to be something that's right for my game. How do I even go about finding the proper grind for me? What would you say if a casual golfer came up and asked you that question? What's kind of the answer for finding the best grind for your wedge set?
Yeah. So I'll start by answering this and saying that, you know, Bob is, if you've never met Bob Vokey, the first thing you meet him, you realize he's no different than you and me.
Right.
Man of the people. He's like one of the greatest human beings on the planet, and everybody loves him, and he loves everybody in return. And when he designs lines, he designs for everybody. You know, he would always say, like in the early stages, like, we don't have enough. We got to do this. We got to change this. We got to make this. And as the years have gone by and I've watched him do these different things, you know, you realize and you learn over the years of traveling that there are so many different golf courses, grass types, soil types, conditions, whether they be wet, dry, you know, grainy, whatever it may be, you need to have a variety of different tools, bounces, things like that, that will, in a sense, give anybody around the world who loves the game of golf and wants to play Vokey wedge the opportunity to get wedges in their bags that work. And that's really kind of what our line is based around. As far as the fitting aspect goes, I always tell people, get yourself in a situation with somebody who has all the different wedges and try them. If you have somebody that you trust who's a good fitter, go see that person. Get some insight. Blindly fit yourself or have somebody blindly fit you. You don't go in bias, because when you leave a fitting, you realize, man, that is, I'm leaving with three or four wedges that I didn't even think I'd use.
Right. Exactly.
And you begin to understand the reasons why, because you're not invested already mentally in four wedges that you think you might take. So, you know, find somebody you like or that has the tools that is educated in fitting. Go to a place that's outdoors so you can watch ball flight and test and try. And you decide, you know, you hit different grinds and you realize, man, I really like this. I don't really care for this. And when you're done with that session, not only do you walk away with what you know you need, but you walk away more educated about things that you didn't know and maybe things that you didn't realize. And we see that with tour players. Honestly, every single year I meet a new tour player who comes out and goes, I've never really been fit like this before. And I'm leaving with all this new knowledge that I had no idea. I had no idea that I needed these things. We saw with JT Poston when he came out last December, you know, he realized, you know, these grinds that I have in the bag, like, I didn't even know I needed them. And it makes perfect sense now, you know. So we get into situations like that all the time. But anybody who goes out and gets a fitting, go see somebody, try the different grinds, and determine what works best for you.
All right. We always want to know what's inside the bags of the tour pros that we watch on TV, but what's your wedge setup? I got to know.
Mine changes throughout the years. My lofts don't change. I play 46, 50, 54, 58. Those are the lofts that I tend to really like, but I do throughout the calendar year change grinds just because I want to better educate myself on what things feel like. And I want to be able to kind of talk and walk the walk with our guys from week to week, you know, be able to tell them like, hey, this grind does this, this one feels like this and sounds like this. So I try and mix things up. Currently I'm using S grinds in my 54 and 58. I'll definitely move into L's as things get a little crispier, and a couple T's, and then I'll go into some K's, and I'll just kind of experiment and goof off a little bit. I don't stamp any of my stuff. I know that's probably disappointing for a lot of people. like, you must stamp everything. But, you know, the reality is that I don't stamp any of my stuff. I just test it and try it and learn from it and then put it in storage.
For someone who's interested in doing what you do, what's the one piece of advice you'd give them?
I would say anybody who wants to do this job, get yourself exposed to clubs. Learn to fit, learn to grind, learn to build. Put in as much time as you can. Honestly, you know, that's something about this industry that I've learned over the years is you can't be lazy. You got to be a go-getter. You got to go get these key roles, these key jobs. Everybody's fighting for these jobs. There's not a lot of them out there, and the guys who typically get them are guys who are go-getters. You know, they want to learn. They work hard. They're interested. They're curious. And I would tell anybody who would be interested in taking a job or going for jobs like these to be that kind of guy, you know, be a go-getter, expose yourself as much as you can and, you know, kind of let the cards fall where they do.
Aaron, thanks again for being on the Fully Equipped Podcast. We really appreciate your time.
Hey, thank you very much.
And that'll do it for episode 29 of Fully Equipped. Big thanks to Aaron Dale for the time. Be sure to check out our social channels for more gear news. We're at @fully_equipped on Twitter and @fullyequippedgolf on Instagram. We'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening.